Any engineer would have it too.
True, admitted the captain, but none of them ran off on their own to undertake an unauthorized mission. None of them showed a serious lapse in judgment. The niceties aside, Saru knew what was expected of him, and he chose to proceed despite that.
She shook her head.
I don't like this line of reasoning any more than you do, Michael. Saru has served under me for a long time, and he is a valued member of this crew.
But no matter how unpalatable, we have to consider all the possibilities, concluded the first officer. He may be under duress. He may be compromised in some way. Captain, I think security should check out Lieutenant Saru's quarters. Look for anything unusual, anything amiss.
I'll do it, Burnham broke in. You're right, Commander. If anyone knows Saru best on this ship, it's me.
That might not have been true, but again she felt compelled to defend the absent Kelpian.
I don't need security to accompany me. I can do it alone. She looked to the captain. I'll be discreet.
At length, Georgiou gave a nod.
All right, Michael. See that you are.
Do you have a family?
Hekan asked the question as she stared down at the floor of the elevator. The Pelear engineer looked up and met Saru's gaze.
Is that something your species possess?
Yes, he replied and clicked his tongue. It was a uniquely Kelpian action, a way to fill an awkward pause rather than give a direct answer.
I have been away from my homeworld for quite some time.
Hekan blinked.
All I want is to see my daughters again. Do you think, when they do it, it will be quick?
All at once, he realized that the engineer believed they were being taken to their execution.
No. I mean, Hekan, they're not going to kill us.
How do you know that?
She threw a worried glance at the red bands and the weapons they carried.
The things I have heard about them. I dismissed it all as rumors spun by the narrow-minded, but now I can't help wondering, what if those stories are true?
What stories?
That the Gorlan tribalist society is inherently aggressive. They actually have a culture that believes in ephemeral deities, and some people say those beliefs direct them to violent behavior against all outsiders, all aliens.
Hekan spoke as if she was sharing a secret with him.
Who says that?
Asked Saru.
People from your planet?
No. Hekan seemed taken aback by the suggestion.
Batans try not to prejudge. It's how we are raised. I meant people from Alpha Moon. They're more forthright in their views.
Like Commander Nathal.
Hekan nodded.
Most command cadre are from Alphan nobility. Nathal comes from a long line of starship officers.
Were the Alphans the ones responsible for the Gorlan?
Saru searched for the right word.
The Gorlan relocation? The flash of guilt on Hekan's face told him that they were not.
Pelear Zell only wanted to help them.
Did you think to ask the Gorlans what they wanted?
Said Saru, without weight to the question.
We did our best, but they make it so difficult to communicate with them. Sometimes I think they can understand us, but they choose not to. I have tried myself, but it never seems to bridge the gap, and we do not have the advanced universal translator systems as you do in Starfleet, and—
She caught herself and trailed off.
I apologize. I am afraid. It makes me talkative.
I am afraid, Saru agreed with a sigh. Most of the time. But I've learned to live with it.
And I am still learning to understand when a threat is truly apparent and when it is not.
She studied him.
You are an unusual being, Saru.
I am told that quite often, he noted as the elevator slowed to a halt.
Once again, Saru was marched onto the command deck of the Pelear freighter, and it struck him how sparse it seemed. Only a handful of the operations consoles and podiums dotted around the chamber were online and active, the rest of them in some form of standby mode.
He cast around, observing the few Gorlans standing sentinel there. One element of his mind was considering what function each podium control performed, while another, more basic part of him looked for potential avenues of escape.
"Lieutenant Saru never enters a room without knowing at least three ways out of it," Commander Chithalo had once said of him, and the Andorian had been mocking him. But he was right, and Saru saw nothing unwise about it. The speaker Vetch disengaged from a hushed conversation with the white-haired Gorlan and approached. He produced the universal translator that had been taken from Saru what seemed like a lifetime ago, and the Kelpian saw immediately that the device had been half-dismantled and then reassembled with an ugly clutter of new components fitted to it. His heart sank.
"What did you do?"
Without a fully functioning UT, communicating with the Gorlans would become 100 times more difficult. Vetch slapped the rod-like device into his open palm.
"We improved upon it. The unit functions far more efficiently now."
Saru blinked. Rendered through the translator, Vetch's previously broken, stilted speech pattern was now an order of magnitude more precise. He held up the UT and saw that among the new components rigged to it were a complex sensor antenna and a signal processor. As Vetch spoke, Saru felt the tingle of the ever-present Gorlan aura field, and it seemed that the modified translator now had the capacity to pick up on that energy and merge it with vocal patterns, tones, and inflections.
"Our species may have the appearance of simplicity,"
Vetch went on, showing his teeth in a smug grin.
"But as you can see, we too have a mastery of technology. But we do not choose to let it dominate every aspect of our life, unlike some cultures."
The speaker eyed Hekan. Saru studied the translator closely. "If you could do this, why wait until now? You had the chance to speak directly to us when you were on board the Shenzhou."
"Sometimes it is better to be underestimated by those around you," said Vetch. "It reveals the truth of things far sooner." "And we have learned not to trust those who have mouths full of promises," said the white-haired Gorlan, coming closer. "It is our way to find a path through adversity without relying on the charity of others. All too often gifts come with a price."
He glared at the Paliar engineer.
"She knows. Mado, if you will."
Vetch addressed the other Gorlan.
"Let me deal with this. I am speaker, after all. It is my role." "I will help you make them understand," Mado replied, and made no move to leave.
"That is what we want," said Saru, seeing an opening. "To understand." He weighed the translator rod in his hand. "Thank you for this. Now that we can speak more clearly to one another, I hope there will be no more need for conflict between us."
"Are you not angry that your companion was injured?" said Mado. "Do you not want recompense?"
"This is not the time for that," Saru said warily. Mado made a guttural noise accompanied by brief, hard jolts of invisible aura static. The translator rendered it as derisive amusement. Undaunted, Saru pressed on. "Before, when we used only the vocal component to converse, much was unclear. But I understand there is a more ephemeral element to your communications." He gestured at the air. "An electromagnetic aura. My species has a similar sense."
"The Paliar and the humans are dead to it,"
Vetch replied dismissively.
"We know it as..."
The translator struggled with the term, briefly unable to parse the name into something Saru could grasp. Eventually, the device rendered the term as the Circle. "That makes sense," Saru thought. "The collective aura field of a Gorlan community is a circle, a unity that encloses them all." It wasn't that they were a group consciousness or a mass mind like some hive species the Federation had documented, What the Gorlands seemed to possess was something simpler than that, a connection that existed beyond words, a shared, almost tangible sense of harmony.
"I do not understand," ventured Hekan.
"Of course not," said Vetch, a little sadly. "How could you?"
Saru turned to the Pelear. "You must have seen avians flying in a flock on your world. Have you ever wondered how it is they can move and turn in unison? The Gorlan Circle is their equivalent of that group connection. I believe it is the basis of their higher communication, and a core component of their societal structure."
"You do not speak like an engineer," said Mado, looking the Kelpian up and down.
One of the Gorlan's hands drifted toward the disruptor pistol clipped to his vest. The Kelpian hesitated. "You are correct. I am Lieutenant Saru. I am a scientist."
"I told you to bring us engineers."
Vetch shot a hard look at the Gorlans that had escorted Hekan and Saru to the command deck. "I insisted they take me instead," Saru continued. "I am the senior officer. I will not send my people into any danger I am not willing to face myself." The words were paraphrased from a page of the Starfleet officer's leadership manual, and he could not help thinking they sounded a little hollow as he repeated them.
"You want to show courage? Is that it?"
Mado came uncomfortably close.
"I think you have little experience of such things."
"Nevertheless, I am here." Saru stood his ground. "What do you want with us? You already have control of this ship."
"No, they don't," Hekan said quietly.
Vetch made a spitting noise.
"The female is right. The Pelears are devious."
Saru was about to ask what the speaker meant by that, but Mado interposed himself and continued to stare at the Kelpian.
"You think you know what is going on here? You are mistaken."
Mado's hooded gaze reminded Saru all too much of a hungry predator considering its next meal.
"Do you know why my kind are on this ship?"
"The government of Pelear Zell is relocating you on another planet," said Saru, "although I believe there may be more to that action than is apparent to me."
"Good answer, outworlder."
Mado showed his teeth.
"The reality of this was hidden from you and your starship Shenzhou."
"Hidden from all beyond Pelear Zell, I do not doubt," added Vetch.
"We are here because the Pelears forced us onto these ships."
Mado's temper darkened.
"They withheld food and shelter. They told us this was the only way for us to survive. We made planetfall on their Alpha Moon, but they would not allow us to remain there."
"He omits the fact that they landed on Alpha without permission," retorted Hekan.
"We had no choice,"
Vetch told her.
"Our vessels were overloaded, damaged and failing. We had to abandon them. Some of her kind accused us of being the vanguard of an invasion force," Mado told Saru, pointing at the engineer. "As if we could have done such a thing. A few 100,000 of us, desperate and clinging to life."
"We helped them,"
Hekan said hotly, looking to Saru.
"I know for a fact Beta Moon donated a huge amount of supplies to the relief effort."
"We did not want your pity and charity," Mado said coldly. "A measure of trust would have been enough."
Saru held his silence. Where was the truth in all of this? He felt out of his depth here. It was one thing to attempt to better communicate with an alien race, but quite another to be drawn into a hijacking and armed revolt. Finally, he came to the question he knew would have to be answered. "You had Hekan and me brought up here for a reason. What is it?"
"Show him," growled Mado.
Vetch led Saru to what appeared to be the freighter's main helm. Although the iconographic Pelear text was foreign to him, Saru soon grasped the layout of the panel, finding the equivalent of an astrogator display and the ship's course correction controls. Aside from the navigation screen, where a dot representing the freighter made slow progress along a curving line, every other control was totally inert. Vetch made a show of tapping several controls, each time rewarded by a sour bleating tone from the console.
"This ship is fixed on a pre-programmed course to its final destination," said the Gorlan. "It appears to be a fail-safe measure triggered automatically in the event the crew are neutralized."
"They want us to unlock it for them," said Hekan.
"We want full control of this vessel," Mado insisted. "The freedom to go wherever we wish."
Saru studied the command screen closely. "Deactivating this system is a complex task. It would involve decompiling the entire helm control matrix. That is a lengthy process at best." He paused, studying the astrogator. "The final destination point is an M-class planet in a star system 2 days distant from our present location."
"The sanctuary," Vetch said with a snort. "The world where the Pleiars decided to dump us. We prefer to seek our own destiny."
One of Mado's hands dropped to his pistol once more.
"You will unlock the helm, Lieutenant Saru. If you refuse, I will be forced to compel you."
"For beings who think little of charity, you ask for a great deal of assistance," said Saru, and his comment earned him a narrow-eyed glare in return. "Even from a cursory examination, I can see this system is protected by a multimodal recursive encryption algorithm. Breaking the code through brute force means would take until the heat death of the universe."
"You lie!" Vetch snapped. "We are right to distrust you. You are in alliance with the Pleiars, as suspected."
"I am telling you the truth," Saru replied defiantly. Mado's gun came out of its holster, and he aimed it at Hekan's chest.
"Are you certain of that?"
The sound of the disruptor discharge that had struck Johar echoed in Saru's thoughts, and he tensed. He thought of the terrible wound that even a glancing miss from that weapon had left in its wake. A direct hit would mean instant death for the Pleiar engineer.
"What should I do?"
The stated policy of Starfleet Command was not to negotiate with terrorists, but Saru had already compromised once on that point to prevent deaths aboard the Shenzhou. Now he was backed into the same corner.
"If I refuse, will they kill Hekan and bring someone else up here? Make the same threat again until I comply? Or will I be the next to perish?"
He met Mado's gaze. It was hard and unreadable. At length, Saru turned back to the helm console. "I can give you no guarantees, but I will make the attempt." 7. A low tremor resonated through the Shenzhou's deck, and Burnham felt it rise through the soles of her boots. She paused by a viewport and glanced out, watching the starfield slip past as the ship began to pick up speed. The engineering team had worked flat out over the last day to repair the damage to the vessel, and although there was still much to be done, the cruiser's impulse drives were finally back online. At last, they were moving again, and if they were moving, then they were doing something to save their missing crewmates. A couple of non-coms farther down the corridor gave a ragged whoop of triumph, but then they caught the sight of Burnham and stiffened. She waved away the moment and gave them a tired smile. If Chitalo had seen it happen, the first officer might have given them a talking to about decorum, but Michael could relate. The past hours had dragged on everyone. The impotent sense of being hobbled and left for dead by the sneak attack was a weight bearing down on the entire crew. Little was worse than feeling like you could do nothing to help, she thought, passing the two technicians as she made her way toward the senior crew quarters. Now that they were on their way, the crew's focus would be renewed. Burnham imagined that Lieutenant Commander Johar would have been proud to see how hard his engineers had worked to get Shenzhou mobile again, many of them putting in double or even triple shifts. Still, they were a long way from being warp-capable, and at interstellar distances it would take forever for them to catch up with the missing Pilyar freighter. But this wasn't about the cold facts. It was about belief. Thinking of the chief engineer made her dwell on the fate of the rest of the rescue party. Were they still alive? Johar, Saru, Wheaton, and the others? Burnham had lost friends and crewmates in the line of duty before, but each time she felt the pain of it anew. For all her embrace of Vulcan stoicism, there was an undeniable kernel of human empathy in her that never went away.
Perhaps once upon a time I would have wanted to silence it. But not now.
Burnham halted outside the door to Lieutenant Saru's cabin, pausing to check the setting on the tricorder hanging on the strap over her shoulder. Setting the device into scan mode, she pulled a data card from her pocket and inserted it in a hidden slot near the door's locking mechanism. An override code provided by Commander Chithalo did the rest, granting her entry into the Kelpian's quarters. She hesitated on the threshold, self-consciously looking left and right down the corridor to see if anyone else was observing. Burnham wanted to tell herself that this was in Saru's best interest, and that she would be proving he wasn't under any kind of malign influence. But any way you looked at it, entering his quarters without permission was a violation. Being here alone might be an attempt to protect his privacy, but if she was honest with herself, Burnham's own curiosity as a xenoanthropologist was piqued by the opportunity to learn more about her standoffish crewmate. The door hissed closed behind her as she stepped through, and Burnham took a breath, committing to the act.
"Okay," she said aloud. "What do you have to tell me, Saru?"
She cleared her mind and tried to take everything in, attempting to get a sense of the being who lived here. On a basic level, the layout of Saru's quarters was little different from Burnham's own, a single occupancy cabin for a junior bridge officer with a bed in one section and an open living area in the other. But the lighting level was much lower than the brighter setting she preferred, the air slightly cooler. The atmosphere in Burnham's cabin was a temperate near-analog to the Vulcan norms she was familiar with, while Saru seemed to favor gloom and shadows. She waited to let her eyes adjust. It didn't surprise her that the fastidious Kelpian's quarters were neat and tidy. Spare uniforms hung near the fabricator alcove, meticulously folded so that their longer legs wouldn't drag on the floor. The automated fresher unit was spotless, and if it hadn't been for the single empty mug resting on the disposal pad of the cabin's food slot, she might have been forgiven for thinking the device had never been used. There was a box of herbal tea bags on a shelf close by, next to a container of what she first thought was sugar, but turned out to be table salt. Burnham made a slow orbit of the room, leading with the tricorder, scanning for anything that might be an anomaly. She detected the additional layer of acoustic shielding in the walls. It seemed to be functioning normally, but there was a peak appearing at the lowest levels of the sensor bands. She retuned the tricorder to focus on the discovery. There was something on the walls, flecks of an inorganic compound scattered here and there in what seemed to be a random manner. When she asked the device to analyze it, the conclusion it presented seemed incongruous.
Ink?
Burnham raised an eyebrow and spoke to the air. Computer, acknowledge.
Waking from standby mode, said a synthetic voice from a console on the far wall. Do you wish to reset?
She wasn't sure what that meant, and glossed over the question.
Yes, I suppose so. I want to access environmental control for this compartment. Specifically, please reattune the local light frequency to...
Burnham studied the analysis.
This setting.
She sent the data to the ship's computer and waited.
Working.
If Burnham was correct, then the alteration of the lighting would allow her to perceive the interior of the cabin as if she were looking at it through Kelpian eyes. Saru's eyes. There was a brief blink of blue-shifted color, and the landscape of the room suddenly changed. The effect was like night and day. One moment, Burnham had been staring at blank, polymer-coated walls, and the next she was seeing a matrix of glyphs written across the floors, the walls, the ceiling. She dropped into a crouch to take a closer look.
This is the Kelpian language? Did Saru write all this?
Burnham was aware that some species in Starfleet altered their quarters in subtle ways to accommodate their personal or cultural needs, but she had never come across something like this. Tiny, tightly packed script in Saru's careful hand moved in long lines from the doorway, up and around, and back again.
What does it say?
She scanned a short section and ran it through a translation program. It was part of what appeared to be a poem. Perhaps this was how his people recorded their history, honored their culture, by scribing it onto every available surface in an ink that could be perceived only at extreme ultraviolet light frequencies. The glow that illuminated the text also gave light to something else, a rectangular box sitting next to Saru's desktop console. At first glance, Burnham had thought it unimportant. But under the changed illumination, it was bright with subtle striations and intricate carving. The box was as long as her forearm and carved from a dark, dense wood. The smoothness of the shape suggested it was old and careworn. She couldn't help but run her fingers over the surface of the lid, feeling a regular grid of indentations and symbols impressed upon it. Burnham hesitated at the thought of opening it. Aside from the glyphs, the cabin contained nothing else that she would have considered to be a personal item. Everything else was standard Starfleet issue. Peering inside the box felt like a step too far. Instead, she scanned it with the tricorder. The device registered small objects inside made of metal, glass, and bone, but nothing that seemed unusual. It was then that she saw the motion of the shadow from the corner of her eye. A deep black shape made of hard angles, the surface of it glassy like obsidian. It advanced slowly, and she realized that it had used the change in light levels to move silently around behind her. The questions of what this intruder was or how it came to be in Lieutenant Saru's quarters were pushed aside. The shape moved like a threat, and she found herself emulating the Kelpian, tensing for the danger to approach. But where Saru's instinct might have been to draw back and escape, Michael Burnham's was rooted in a very different impulse. There was a lamp on the end of the desk, and she slipped her hand toward it, fingers gripping the heavy base. It would serve as a makeshift weapon. The shadow seemed to discern her intentions, and it came across the remaining distance in a flurry of silent movement. Drawing on the Susmana defensive training she had learned in her youth, Burnham pivoted away and got her first good look at the intruder. Tholian. It could be nothing else. The distinctive crystalline shape, in this form, with the six spindly legs clustered together into a tripedal configuration. The arms like scimitar blades slicing toward her. The two smoldering eye spots glaring out of the gloom at Burnham. It was impossible for the alien to be here, and yet it was. The surface of its faceted skin was night black instead of the hot orange-red Burnham knew from Starfleet visual records, a signifier that this intruder was one of the rumored stealth aspects, the Tholian equivalent of an elite covert soldier class. The blade-like arms stabbed toward her, and she jolted back out of the way. Something was wrong. It all seemed illogical, but Burnham couldn't bring herself to stop and reason it through. She should have run for the door, should have screamed for security as loudly as she could, but in that instant, Michael Burnham was caught in her pure emotional reaction. She swung the lamp around in a hard arc, and the weighted end connected with the brow of the Tholian's head, and passed right through it, encountering nothing. She was so shocked by the reaction that she didn't avoid the counterblow coming the other way. The ink-dark intruder stabbed her through the chest with its right arm, the glassy length of it piercing her sternum. But there was no pain, no sensation, nothing at all, The Tholian stood there, frozen in time.
"Failure condition," said the computer. "Your reaction time was insufficient to avoid a fatality. Simulation concluded. Do you wish to reset?"
"No," snapped Burnham, and the phantom intruder vanished in a glitter of holographic pixels. She drew in a shaky breath and muttered an ancient word in low Vulcanian, self-consciously rubbing at the spot on her chest where the crystalline being would have stabbed her.
"Tvyak!"
The Vulcans didn't have many ways to curse, but Burnham remembered that one, and she said it with feeling.
"Please restate command," said the synthetic voice.
"What was that?" she demanded. "That Tholian! Why did it attack me?"
"Personal holographic program designated Saru-6. Automated aggressor simulation keyed to trigger at random intervals."
"Purpose?"
"Controlled stimulation and moderation of Kelpian fight-or-flight response to facilitate continued emotional stability."
"Oh." Suddenly it made sense to her. Burnham's first thought had been that the hologram was some kind of alarm system, a trap for the uninvited entering Saru's quarters just as she had. But it was nothing of the kind. It was a test. Just as Burnham would regularly engage in workouts down in the Shenzhou's gym or sparring matches with an automated opponent, Saru had his own version of that exercise in the form of this program.
"He can't exist without some kind of danger at hand," she said aloud, carefully putting the lamp back where she had found it. "Even if it's just a simulated one."
The words brought her thoughts into sharp focus. Saru had never made it easy to serve alongside him, his fussy, often prickly manner causing friction over the most trivial of things. But she respected his skills, even if she would rarely tell him so. The Kelpian had a keen analytical mind and a strong intuitive manner that would have served him better had he not been so inward-looking. For all his distance, his aloofness, Saru was a driven being, and the hologram program showed it.
"He's always pushing himself," thought Burnham, "even if the rest of us don't see it."
That Saru was competing with her had never been in doubt, but now she wondered how much it cost him to do that. She felt a twinge of empathy for him. Burnham understood all too well what it was to be driven, to be constantly tested, and to be secretly afraid of faltering and failing those around her.
"If there's anything wrong with Saru, it's that. He went back to the Pliar ship because he was pushing. And he got in over his head."
"You didn't see what you were walking into, did you?" She asked the question to the air.
"You looked, but you couldn't see."
Burnham trailed off as her own words echoed around the empty room.
"Couldn't see," she repeated,
and a sudden head rush came over her, the realization of something she had missed.
"Because I was looking at it with the wrong eyes."
She rocked off her heels, abruptly propelled by her new flash of insight.
"Have to get to the lab. The monitor buoy. I know what to do."
Burnham hesitated at the door, remembering Chithalo's orders about checking Saru's quarters. She tapped the intercom panel on the wall. "Lieutenant Burnham to XO."
"Go ahead, Lieutenant,"
the Andorian answered immediately. "I've completed my survey as requested," she said briskly. "No anomalies found. Saru is still Saru. That's the problem as much as it is the solution. Burnham out." She cut the channel before the first officer could reply and set off at a rapid pace toward the lab decks. If Chithalo wanted to find a way to place the blame on the Kelpian's shoulders, he would have to do it without her help. The Gorlans left Saru to work on the helm control podium, and when it was clear that the Pliar engineer was unable to assist him, Vetch had two of the red bands escort her below. He watched the speaker closely, trying to gauge his intentions. Would Vetch or his people be so callous as to take Hekan away to be killed? What purpose would that serve? It was difficult to remain focused on the problem at hand when his thoughts continually drifted off toward worries about the fate of the rescue party and the Poliars. One of the other Gorlans, a female named Kijo, was assigned to give Saru whatever he needed to do the job, but he suspected she was there to act as his watcher. Kijo had tightly cropped, sand-yellow hair that fell into a stubby queue down her back, and her round face bore a recent scar below one eye. She told him she had been a pilot aboard one of the ships that had borne the Gorlans to the Poliarzel system, and that she understood the helm system of the Starfreighter. Saru took that as a subtle warning from Kijo that she would know if he was trying to interfere with the controls or stall the work in any way. Saru managed to get the control podium to switch into a self-diagnostic mode, and as he watched, a seemingly endless stream of computer code fell through a display readout on the illuminated panel. His tricorder dutifully scanned it line by line, attempting to find a loophole in the lockout software, but the task was slow and tedious. Not only did the data need to be translated from the Poliar language into Federation standard, but the alien operating system had to be rendered into something Starfleet tech could interface with. Saru sighed and gave Kijo a sideways glance, feeling the need to fill the wary silence between them. "If I may ask, the colony your people left, were you present when the Tholians attacked it?" The Gorlan's severe green eyes fixed him with a glare.
"Are you saying we lied about that?"
"No." He held up his hand. "Why would you assume so?"
"How do you think I got this scar?"
Kijo countered, then let out a breath.
"I have been questioned 100 times by Poliars from the first day we fell into orbit around their Alpha Moon. Did the Tholians really attack you? Did you provoke the situation? How many ships were there? What did you do to antagonize them? Did you fire first?"
Her jaw worked as if she were chewing on something tough and unpalatable.
"I was on the surface when they came in their spinner ships. That saved my life. They put their energy webs around our orbital station and dragged it away. The cargo lighter I crewed for was lost then."
"They attacked your planet without a reason?"
Saru studied the Gorlan carefully, watching as her four hands clasped over one another.
"Oh, they had a reason," corrected Kijo. "They didn't care that it made no sense to us. The Tholians said that our colony was inside the borders of their assembly, and it belonged to them. They gave us 1 rotation to leave. 1!
She spat out the word.
"We'd been there for 22 full solar cycles, you understand. Over 400,000 of us. Built lives and towns and chapels. Bonded there. Had litters of young there. It was a home. And then overnight, these aliens came and told us to abandon it."
"But you were aware of the existence of the Tholians," Saru pressed. "This sector of space borders their territory. You could not be ignorant of that."
"We knew what they were," she snapped. "We always respected their boundaries. We kept our distance. We were no threat to them."
Saru gave a solemn nod. "In some circumstances, that is not enough. The Tholian Assembly are extremely aggressive in maintaining their borders." He paused, reading the Gorlan's stiff expression.
"Your people refused to go."
"We drew together to protect the... to protect ourselves."
Kijo made a growling noise in the back of her throat.
"They had no interest in listening to us. When their deadline passed, they started bombarding the colony from space. We had no choice then. We had to flee or die."
She told him how the panicked rout of the Gorlans had claimed almost as many lives as the Tholian beam blasts. A shadow passed over the pilot's face as she recalled their desperate flight to escape the star system, fearful that the dagger-shaped spinners would come after them.
"Our vessels were overloaded and undersupplied. Some went cold out there in the void. We prayed to the Creator for safe harbor,
and when we stumbled on Pilyar Zell, we thought we had found it.
Saru framed his next words very carefully.
You must have known they would be wary. The Pilyars would have been as afraid of you as you were of the Tholians.
Of course. That is why we threw ourselves on their mercy, one sentient to another. And at first, the Pilyars seemed to welcome us.
But that changed when they realized our ships had spent themselves reaching their shores. When they understood we were not going to leave any time soon.
She made the growling noise again.
We didn't want to be there. We wanted to be on our colony, living the lives we had built. Then the Pilyars told us there was no room for us on their moons, just as the Tholians had told us there was no room on the planet we had made our home.
Kijo eyed him.
What would you have done, Saru, if your life was torn away from you?
The question hit the Kelpian with a force he hadn't expected. Saru experienced a sudden and very powerful sense of distance from the world that he had once called home. Taking a breath, he silenced the thought.
I would have run, he answered honestly.
That is what we are doing, said another voice.
Saru turned to see Mado, the bigger red band, walking toward them with a weary swagger, one hand forever on his gun.
What we have been forced into.
He glared at the consul.
It's been several hours, and you do not appear to be making any progress.
Saru knew full well what would come next. The threats. He deliberately stayed where he was, crouched low, but raised up enough that he was at eye level with the shorter Gorlan, rather than towering over him in a way that would unconsciously trigger an aggressive response. From what I have been able to determine, the only way to halt this vessel's progress would be to directly interfere with the power train from the warp core. Mado's lips curled.
We can do that. We did it before.
He nodded at Kijo.
You agree with the alien?
I agree that we cannot divert this ship from its automated heading, not without breaking something vital, said the pilot.
It wasn't the answer Saru or Mado was expecting. The Gorlan red band flexed his hands irritably, jabbing two of them at the Kelpian.
He said it is possible.
Possible. And very dangerous, Saru broke in. I believe that if you attempt to force this ship out of warp again, the cascade effect that threatened to destroy it last time will reoccur. This time, the Nadion pulse will be much more severe.
You prevented it, then. You can do so again.
Mado dismissed his concerns with a snort.
No, I cannot!
Saru's exasperation finally broke its banks, and he almost shouted.
Please, tell him!
He implored Kijo.
The alien is right, said the pilot flatly. Interfere with the drive, and it will kill us all.
Mado's sneer grew.
Has the Federation's timidity tainted you, Kijo? Where's the boldness you showed when we broke through the Tholian blockade?
He made a point of studying her scar.
You are confusing bravery with desperation, Kijo replied. We are on this journey to the end, like it or not.
Belatedly, Saru realized that the Gorlan pilot had been observing his work on the helm controls more closely than he had thought.
That is unacceptable, spat Mado. If we cannot break this chain, then we need to find another way to stop the vessel.
He raised his voice so that all the other Gorlans on the command deck could hear him. Saru watched them pause and listen to their leader.
I do not wish to kill in cold blood, he went on. It is not our way. But our prayers go unanswered, and for the Creator's sake, we cannot stand with hands bound while the Pilyars continue to control us.
Mado marched to the helm console.
We have them as our captives, and yet still they are in command of this vessel. How much longer must we march to the demands of outworlders?
His angry words drew affirming nods from many of the other Gorlands. Saru saw what was coming. Violence will not change the facts. You cannot coerce reality into reforming itself to your needs with a destructive act.
So, ending your life would make no difference?
Mado's voice dropped to a low, threatening register. It would not, he managed, tensing his muscles. Saru's threat ganglia stirred at the back of his skull, and it took a physical effort to stop them from emerging. He did not want to give the Gorlan the satisfaction of knowing how afraid he was.
We can't shoot our way through this, Mado, said Kijo. Haven't you realized that yet?
Then what should we do?
Mado's hand dropped away from his weapon, and he snarled at the other Gorlan.
You and the alien here have more intellect than I, so please, educate me!
You are frustrated, began Saru, and that expresses itself in anger. I know how that feels.
You do?
Mado cocked his head, his tone half amused, half insulting. Saru went on. It accomplishes nothing.
I disagree.
Mado's words became icy cold.
Violence stole my home from me. Threats drove me onto this rusting, creator-forsaken hulk. Those things have worked well against me, so now I see no fault in directing the same toward others.
You are so desperate that you would kill another sentient being. Saru made it a statement, not a question, but Mado took it as the latter.
Yes, he retorted. If that is the act that must be committed, I will not shrink from it, no matter what words you use to bar the way. I will do what must be done to ensure the survival of our colony and our...
Mado's rage almost carried him to the end of the sentence, but he caught himself in time and clamped his jaw shut. It was the second time that Saru had witnessed one of the Gorlans trying to conceal something, and his eyes narrowed as he pieced together what those silenced words might be. He remembered what the translation matrix had rendered out of the voices he captured after first encountering the Gorlans. What was it they had spoken of? What was the name? The Hub. Saru drew up the words and spoke them quietly, but the response from the Gorlans was as if they had been hit by an electric shock. Mado actually flinched, reacting like he had suffered a physical blow. At his side, Kijo gave Saru a long and measuring look.
The alien needs to know, if we want any of them to understand how important it is, to know why we are so desperate to act, we must show him.
Mado's bellicose behavior had shifted in an instant to a more reverent manner.
Outworlders are not permitted to approach the Hub.
These are extreme times, said Kijo, spreading all four of her hands. The old strictures count for nothing.
Saru was aware that every Gorlan on the command deck was staring at him, and he felt more threatened than he had since first boarding the Paliar ship. Slowly, Mado's simmering anger returned.
Very well.
He beckoned the Kelpian toward him.
You want to see? To know us? Then follow.
Saru cautiously walked after the red band, with Kijo trailing a step behind him. A cold sense of foreboding made his skin prickle. He knew that in speaking those words he had crossed a line with the Gorlans that could never be taken back. It had been hard work hauling the isophotonic emitter unit up from the Shenzhou's engineering decks to the analysis lab on her own, with only one semi-functional antigrav, but with all the starship's technicians engaged in repairs, there was no other way to carry the rig. She managed it, though, keeping out of the way as Johar's people tried their best to put the starship's warp drive back together. They were fighting an uphill battle. The surprise attack from the Pleiar ship's particle weapons had destroyed a key component of the warp field coil, something called an axis control that Burnham recalled vaguely from her elective classes in space warp theory. Without it, the Shenzhou's warp bubble would become unstable when it tried to exceed the speed of light, with catastrophic results. The engineers were in the process of fabricating a replacement, but the component was extremely intricate and would take days to manufacture.
Days of traveling at impulse power.
In the infinite void of space, even that incredible velocity was glacially slow. At such a rate, it would take decades to reach the current endpoint of the freighter's ion trail, and the Pleiar ship was still moving away from them. Burnham considered the thought with clinical logic and then discarded it. There was no point dwelling on a problem that she could not fix. Instead, she would focus on a matter she could solve. She set up the isophotonic rig around the opened space frame of the monitor buoy they had recovered days earlier and aimed the emitter head at the solid-state memory bank inside. The buoy's data storage device was corrupted by the backwash of whatever energy shock had struck it, and to most observers, that would have been evidence enough that it had been wiped clean. But digital information never really went away, and inside complex storage systems like the duotronic components of the buoy, the phantom imprint of the data was still there. Pieces of it, jumbled together, but perhaps still readable. Burnham imagined her well-thumbed copy of Alice's Adventures in Wonderland, but with the paper book's pages cut up, shredded and tossed into a pile. The data in the damaged memory bank was the same, a decoupe of broken pieces that she might be able to reassemble, given time. "The key," she said out loud, "is to look at things with different eyes." The emitter threw a beam into the metallic crystal structure of the memory module, and Burnham pulled up a real-time display on a nearby monitor. As the beam sought out and bounced back off tiny fragments of intact code, they flashed up on the screen. If enough of them were intact, it was possible that she might be able to reconstruct the last few seconds of the buoy's operational life. Hours passed in a blur, and Burnham was drawn into the slow action of the scanner device, watching it assemble vague shapes and half-formed images by raking through the digital ashes of the damaged memory. She was so intent on the screen that it took her a moment to notice that the door had hissed open behind her. Captain Georgiou entered the compartment with a purposeful stride, but her gait slowed as she caught sight of the jury-rigged engineering tool Burnham had set up in the lab.
"Michael, whatever are you doing with this?"
"A light bulb went off, Captain," she said, making a vague shape over her head. "I was in Saru's cabin, and it came to me from out of nowhere." She pointed at the monitor. "We were looking at this the wrong way, like peering into a room through a tiny hole in the wall. But if we adjust the spectrum of perception, suddenly there's no wall in the way. And all the pieces are laid out in front of us. Before, we couldn't even see the pieces."
"Yes, about Saru,"
said Georgiou, pulling on the conversation before Burnham could lead it away.
"Your report to Commander Cetelo on what you learned from his quarters was, shall we say, rather brisk?"
Burnham faltered.
"Yes, Captain, I guess it was. I'm sorry. I was just distracted."
She paused, considering.
"And to be honest, I thought that terse and snappy was his entire thing."
"Sonny likes it when he's terse and snappy," Georgiou allowed, using the diminutive for the Exo's first name that only she could get away with.
"Junior officers? Not so much. He expressed concern that you might not be wholly objective when it came to Lieutenant Saru's mental state."
She stopped and raised an eyebrow.
"Captain, if the first officer is intimating that my relationship with Saru is anything other than professional..."
Georgiou chuckled.
"It's not that at all. You two quarrel like troublesome siblings."
The smile faded.
"And sometimes siblings cover for each other."
Burnham framed her reply.
You know me better than that, Captain.
I do, she admitted. Sonny is a good exec, but sometimes he sees problems that aren't there. He's more like our Kelpian lieutenant in that way than he'd probably like to admit. The captain paused. I just want to hear you tell me what you really think Saru was doing on that ship.
Saru isn't unbalanced. He isn't under any kind of malign influence. I don't think it is stress or anything like that.
Burnham took a breath. I believe he's just trying to do what he has always tried to do. The right thing. He strives to be a better Starfleet officer and uphold the same oaths and ideals we all do. But that may get him killed. That's the risk that comes with the job, said Georgiou, reaching up to trace the arc of the Delta shield on the breast of her uniform. But it's one we're supposed to share, not carry alone.
Was that directed at me or at Saru?
Burnham was still weighing the question when an alert chime sounded from the computer, drawing the attention of both women. Her pulse jumped at the possibility. If she was right, if this had actually worked... The captain came closer, peering at the flickering image on the screen.
What are we looking at here?
The display was messy and full of disruption artifacts, but it was discernible as a visual feed from one of the monitor buoy's sensor masts. There was only a half second or so of material that could be considered usable, but Burnham's unorthodox recovery process had definitely caught something.
Let me try to compensate for the visual distortion.
She ran the imagery through a software filter to sharpen it up, but it did little to help. The footage appeared to show a smooth-edged, regular object crossing the edge of the buoy's locked visual field. Then, the object seemed to change shape, compacting its long axis and then expanding in diameter. Radiation effects grew as the images replayed until a whiteout smothered everything and the playback started again. Georgiou shook her head, looking at the other data streams from the memory bank.
This doesn't help. If we had readings from the mass spectrometer, gravity sensor, particle counter, anything, it would help to interpret what we're looking at. It's not a piece of debris, a comet, or an asteroid, said Burnham. Look, it very distinctly changes aspect and course.
She slowed down the footage.
That's why it appears to alter its shape, said the captain, reasoning it out. It's an artificial construct. A ship. And it's turning.
Georgiou made a motion in the air with the flat of her hand, like a vessel moving through space.
Turning toward the buoy, coming at it head-on. That's an attack posture.
Yes, it is. Georgiou's expression became grim. Computer! Burnham leaned close to the touch-sensitive screen and used her finger to highlight the object on the display.
Working, came the synthetic reply.
Analyze this shape and extrapolate a complete form for it based on available data. Then project a three-dimensional holographic model of the findings.
Stand by.
If the buoy was deliberately destroyed, that throws up a whole other set of problems for us, said the captain. Not the least of which is, could the Shenzhou be in danger as well? Burnham nodded, unwilling to give voice to the answer she suspected was about to be confirmed.
Rendering complete.
A shadow appeared in midair over the computer console, a long and tapering form that resembled polished black stone. Burnham reached for it, and haptic sensors responded, allowing her to turn the object around in her hands. The shape had a cross-section like an elongated diamond, thick at one end, coming to a sharp point at the other. It instantly suggested the shape of a blade, a weapon. Burnham thought of the ink-dark hologram she had encountered in Saru's quarters and suppressed a shudder.
Is that what I think it is? Georgiou asked.
Computer, Burnham went on,
generate a holographic model of a Tholian spinner-type starship, match scale with unknown object and display. Working.
A second image, this one a metallic crystalline form that was all edges and implied threat, materialized next to the shadow. The similarity in mass and shape was obvious. Computer, what is the probability that the unknown object is a match for the vessel? Said Georgiou.